Why does it always sound like the Houthi spokesperson is screaming? I mean, if you look at the video, there's like 14 cameras there. Does he not think they're working?
Armed forces will not hesitate to target the origin of any threat and all enemy targets in land and on the sea to defend the Yemen.
Welcome to the latest episode of Headlines in History with me, John Mollick. I believe here we're on episode 4, pretty early in our journey here, but nonetheless, we're driving on, right? Today, I want to cover a topic that's been consistently in the news, in the foreign affairs space, okay? Particularly as of late, as a result of the Gaza conflict. But it's really been a concern for national security folks for decades, since the 90s. And that's the Houthis. They're an enigmatic group embroiled in a civil war at home in Yemen. And they have a side hustle conducting attacks on foreign vessels throughout the greater Arabian region, particularly the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea, since really the 2010s, and are now legally identified as a terrorist organization as of this January, I believe January 17th, by the U.S. government. So let's dig into this Shia Muslim organization hell-bent on fighting against the Saudis and exerting their influence throughout their region. Okay, so why are we talking about them today? Why is it really relevant? Well, first, the Houthi problem set really came to the fore globally during the civil war that they're currently having, which started years and years ago and is still going on in their home country of Yemen, which ended up creating a massive humanitarian crisis. I mean, hundreds of thousands of civilians were affected, starving. Many innocent civilians died as a result of the fighting between the Houthis and which is an upstart group against the official government and the capital. And then the Saudis get involved. Now Iran is supporting the Houthis, and they're now like really in a proxy force, much like Hezbollah in Yemen. And it led to a massive humanitarian issue in the 2010s. So it really reached an awareness, a pretty strong awareness from that point. But today, they're back in the media because they're engaged pretty often, pretty regularly, with attacks against Western shipping in particular throughout the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. And we'll talk about why that's particularly of interest. They also attack with ballistic missiles into Saudi Arabia, which, you know, that becomes news really in the Middle East, and that kind of stays within the national security sphere. It doesn't really break out into the mainstream media too much, but the humanitarian crisis did, right? But again, in this national security sphere, it's the Houthis are a group that we're talking about pretty regularly, and it has to do, again, with those attacks on shipping, all right? So let's go back into history. And let's look at why and how a small Shia religiously motivated group in northwest Yemen ended up becoming an international conversation. Okay, so not to insult anyone's intelligence, just give me a couple of seconds here to break down what we're talking about on the map. Okay, so if you're well versed in the Middle East, then you know you can just twiddle your thumbs and ignore me for a minute. But for those that are looking for a little bit of a reminder, let's talk about Yemen in particular. Okay, so if you're looking at a map of the Middle East, particularly the Arabian Peninsula, so where Saudi Arabia occupies most of that peninsula, it's to the southeast of the Mediterranean Sea. Okay, on the south end of that peninsula, south of Saudi are two countries, Yemen to the west and Oman to the east. Just to the north of Oman is the UAE, Qatar, and Bahrain. And that's that water line there between or on the that touches Bahrain, Qatar, UAE, and Oman. That's the Persian Gulf, right? As I said, Yemen and Oman are on the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula. The southern waterway there is the Gulf of Aden. And then on the west side of the peninsula is the Red Sea. Right? And that's what separates the Middle East from Africa. On the east side of the Red Sea is the Arabian Peninsula. On the west side, Egypt, Sudan, Eritrea, Djibouti, and then Somalia kind of is at the southern end there. North of Saudi, Jordan, Iraq, Kuwait, and then just as you might imagine, then just a little bit further north, northwest of Jordan is Israel, and then Gaza Strip and Syria is up there as well. All right, so the Houthis are a small Shia sect, Shia Muslim sect, that small comparatively, right, with the greater population in the region, small Shia sect that lives in the northwest part of Yemen. There are some mountains up there, and that's where they originate from. They are Zaydi Muslims, which makes them Shia in their belief, as opposed to Sunni. So it puts them in the same category, general category, of those Shia that live in Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon, where most Shias in the world live. But their version of Shiism is a little different. They're called fivers, as opposed to the majority of those that live in Iran, which are twelvers. And that just has to do with their beliefs in which imam in the line of succession after Ali is most important. Let's just leave it as basic as that, okay? So, but generally speaking, they are Shia and have a connection with the rest of the Shia Muslims throughout the world, okay? But there are two other important differences other than the fiver point that I just rose, okay? The first is that, as opposed to the traditional, more literalist interpretation of Shia Islam, which most other Shias practice, they have more of a rationalist, conversationalist interpretation of the Quran. So they don't necessarily follow the Quran literally word for word. They have what they believe is the opportunity to kind of interpret what the Quran is saying based on their understanding. Okay, so that makes them a little bit more closely aligned with a Sunni philosophy than it does the Shia philosophy. So that's a little bit different. The other thing is, and then more, the other difference is, and this is what makes it more practical to our conversation today, is that their founder, Zayd ibn Ali, was the grandson of Ali himself, Ali being the son-in-law of Muhammad, the prophet. And Zayd ibn Ali died fighting against a corrupt government. That was kind of his stance, and that's his history, that's his story. And so today, Zaydis believe not only in the difference between the fiver and twelver imam, but they believe in an everyday practice capacity that they are to fight against corrupt governments that are abusing them. That's exactly what ended up leading to the confrontation that exists in Yemen today. They felt that the government in Yemen's capital, Sana'a, was corrupt, and they were right, corrupt and abusing them as an entity, and they needed to fight against that corrupt government. But let me make something clear. So Zaydism, the belief in fiver Shiism, has been around for centuries, but the fight, the civil war that's happening now that we refer to as the Houthis, is a specific group within that greater belief system. And we'll talk about how that came about. Okay. It really came about in the 1990s, which is what most analysts believe. There's no date, there's no time when we can really draw this thing down, but it was the 90s when the Houthis really came together and started fighting outside of their greater, you know, Zaydi Shia brethren. All right, so a good date to go back to, though, to really start the story is 1978. Okay, so a Zaydi himself, a guy by the name of Ali Abdullah Salah, he came to power in northwest Yemen, which is where these individuals were from, where they still are from and where they originate from, right? And at this point in 78 was actually a separate country. There was a North Yemen and a South Yemen. But anyways, so in 1978, Salah comes to power, and in 1990, he ends up unifying the country. No reason for any particular details right now. But anyways, in 1990, the country comes together and it falls under the purview of Salah and his government. So now he's in charge of the whole of Yemen. Now, at the same time, after Salah comes to power after 78 and is attempting to unify the country through the 80s, the Saudis start spending a lot of money spreading the Wahhabist version of Sunni Islam down into the Zaydi region of Yemen. Okay, so again, in that northwest portion of Yemen, this mountainous area where the Zaydis come from, the Sunnis say, The Saudis say, okay, we're going to start building schools and we're going to build institutions down there where we want to start spreading some Sunni Islam. Well, as you might imagine, the Zaydis weren't too happy about that. They actually literally believed that their belief system would disappear, that if the Saudis were sending too much money and sending and constructing too many schools, so they would no longer be who they were. And that was something they couldn't stand for. So eventually, Zaydis, they end up coalescing under a guy by the name of Hussein Badreddin al-Houthi, hence where the Houthi name comes from. He designs a political entity. He designs a political group to try and push back against the Saudi influence that's coming over their northern border. This is separate from the Saleh government, who is attempting to unify all of Yemen at the same time. The Houthis are just really kind of interested in pushing back against the Saudis at this point. Where it gets kind of interesting and where things start to break down between these two separate entities within Yemen is when the United States gets involved, and that's in 2003. Why? We had the Operation Iraqi Freedom. For obviously completely unrelated reasons, the United States made the decision to remove Saddam from power in Iraq. Well, how did that affect Yemen? The United States was obviously looking for as much support as they could get throughout the Middle East. And the president of Yemen, the guy who was who eventually unified in 1990, Saleh, he ended up not outwardly supporting or outrightly supporting President Bush, but wasn't pushing back against the invasion. And that really angered the Houthi movement, who was pushing against the Saudis. Right? The Saudis were, they were supportive of the United States in some way. They didn't stop the United States as if they could, but you know, supportive of the United States, have been an ally of the United States for many years, even way back into, way back during the Cold War, and then through the first invasion of Iraq and Desert Storm in 1990. And so the Houthis were mad that Saleh, the official president, was working together, if you will, with the United States in terms of the invasion of Iraq. In addition, Saleh was an obnoxiously corrupt individual. So he took power in 78, spread, unified the country, and then ended up being worth, $30 billion. Okay, so you might imagine when you have this Zaydi Houthi group whose whole religious philosophy is to fight against corrupt governments, they've got this Saleh guy who ends up working together with the Saudis, indirectly the United States, and then, you know, scrapes up $30 billion from the Yemeni people, not too happy about it. Then things go from bad into worse when in 2004, there are massive protests after the invasion in 2003. The protests grow and things are a bit out of control in Western Yemen with the Houthis. And so Saleh sends a group of individuals, sends military out to quell the protests. And Saleh's military ends up assassinating and killing the original leader of the Houthis. His brother ends up taking over, but Hussein Badreddin al-Houthi ends up dying. Everything breaks loose at that point. So this leads to a direct kinetic conflict. There was more kind of influence between the two groups. You know, there's pushback politically, but there wasn't an outright war. There wasn't an outright conflict. Well, that changed in 2004, now with Houthi being assassinated. It's during this period that the Houthis adopt the motto, death to America and death to Israel. You know, there's you have to throw Israel in there, right? Even though they have a death to America and death to Israel. And then their flag says, Allah is great, death to the USA, death to Israel, curse the Jews, victory to Islam. Now, listen, no irony or confusion there. Straight to the point. I don't blame them. Not bad marketing. If you ask me, good on them, right? At least you know where they're coming from. So you might ask yourself at this point, well, Saudi Arabia, yes, they were meddling a little bit in the 80s and trying to build some Wahhab schools down in Yemen, but how do you think they felt about this chaos now sweeping through Yemen on their southern border between the Houthis and the Saleh government? They're not too happy about it, right? So they end up making a decision, the Saudi government ends up making a decision to support the Saleh government, because it is technically the official government. And they really, I mean, it's a lesser of two evils. They may not necessarily like either group, but they definitely don't like the Houthis. So they support the Salah government. And then what do you think happens in response? Of course, Saudi Arabia's main enemy in the region, Iran, steps up and says, okay, well, if you're going to support the Salah government, then we're going to support the Houthis. And now we have this a direct civil war conflict between these two groups now being supported by two larger players in the region, Saudis with the Salah and Iran with the Houthis. A lot of things happen now throughout the early 2000s after the death of Houthi in 2004. It gets really complicated, but something interesting does happen. At some point, Salah decides to step down. And in doing so, he ends up being replaced by Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi, okay, who also becomes a Saudi partner, if you will. And he struggles, though, to keep Yemen together. So Salah steps down. It's not working for him. Hadi takes over. Hadi's now the president, and he still can't keep Yemen together. And what this ends up doing is Salah, who was kind of independent at the time after he first stepped down, he decides, well, screw it. Hadi's really screwing this thing up, so I'm joining the Houthis. So what began as this, as a battle between the Houthis and Salah, Salah decides later on, when Hadi's not good enough, I'm joining the Houthis. Fantastic. He switches allegiances. So, after all this back and forth, Salah ends up bringing a bunch of his military personnel that were reliant, but you know, connected to him while he was the president. He ends up bringing them along with him when he aligns with the Houthis, and they get together and they end up toppling Hadi's government in 2015. So the Houthis end up in charge of the vast majority of Yemen with Salah's help. After the transition to Hadi. This is also the time when the Houthis decide to rebrand themselves. So, you know, people were just calling them the Houthis because obviously their leader's last name, right? Now they decide to call themselves Ansar Allah, which stands for helpers, partisans, or supporters, depending on your interpretation of God. So helpers of God. Now, as I said in the beginning, this is when the international community really becomes aware of what's happening. The civil war between the two entities and the toppling of the government led to a mass humanitarian crisis. The UN at one point said that up to 80% of the people that were living in Yemen, millions, were in dire need of humanitarian support. They were starving to death. Many, many were dying. Innocent civilians were dying in the crossfire between the two groups, the Saudis involved. It was a mess. And so that's what became really the story for the international community. What is going on down in Yemen in terms of this civil war, and why are all these civilians dying? That has basically continued up until today, that the civil war has not ended. The Houthi Ansar Allah movement continues to fight against the official government in Yemen, even though the Houthi movement now controls the capital. So Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, is in the west, and so the Houthis control it. But it, again, they're not the internationally recognized government of Yemen, and so they're in control of the capital, but they control 30-ish percent of the whole country. Today, you know, at one point they controlled the whole, almost all of it, and then were pushed back when the Saudis jumped in. But so where we stand today, again, 30%. Civil war continues. We have an Iranian-backed Shia movement fighting against a Saudi-backed government who hates Israel for obvious reasons. They hate Saudi, the Houthis, and the U.S. for the Iraq invasion and its support of Saudi and Israel. So aside from the humanitarian crisis, how does this civil war end up affecting the rest of the region? Ever since the Iranian support started with the Houthis years ago, specifically to the civil war, the Houthis have now decided to take that support, whether it be weapons and money, training, whatever it is that they can get from Iran, and they utilize that stuff against other mission sets, like attacking Israel, attacking Saudi Arabia, and now attacking ships in the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea. So they're not just keeping their business at home, if you will. They've become somewhat of an annoyance to the countries surrounding Yemen that they attack, that the Houthis attack. And but the concern is not just that they're an annoyance, but some of the actions that they take could end up becoming devastating, have devastating consequences, not just, again, not just annoying little attacks that are like pinpricks, if you will. Let me give you some examples of how some of their actions can end up being a little bit more negatively influential. For one, the Houthis fire a significant amount of ballistic missiles into Saudi Arabia and other places. They've hit the UAE as well, and they launch drones into Israel. But particularly, they fire a lot of their ballistic missiles, which they get from Iran, into Saudi Arabia. One estimate has between 2015 and 2021, the Houthis firing 430 ballistic missiles and about 851 armed drones at Saudi targets alone. And that really started with the first major attack in 2017 when the Houthis claimed missile attacks that they shot at the King Khalid Airport. The Saudis came out and they blamed Iran and Hezbollah, interestingly enough, on top of Yemen, on top of the Houthis. So as you might have imagined, Iran responded and said, "That's not us. I don't know what you're talking about." And Hezbollah also said the same thing. Now, why do you think Saudi would have blamed Iran? That one's obvious, right? They give them the weapons. But Hezbollah, let's just say most likely, because Hezbollah is very good at what it does. It's been a proxy for Iran for much longer than the Houthis have, and they have a lot of experience fighting against Israel. So let's say it's more than likely that Hezbollah has decided to extend a helping hand in terms of training and operational support for the Houthis, which would leave the Saudis to believe that Hezbollah is potentially involved. Another quote, annoyance that can end up being pretty devastating is, and one of the reasons we're talking about this today, is that the Houthis, as they attempt to target ships or do target ships off their coastline. Right? This started, there was a really large example in 2015 when the Houthis attacked the FSO Safer, which is a massive oil vessel. It's a Yemeni-owned vessel. It was constructed years ago by the Japanese. The Japanese sold the ship, the oil vessel, to the Yemeni government in 1987. It could carry up to 1.14 million barrels of oil. The Houthis, in 2015, struck the ship and seized it in an attempt to take all the oil off of it and then sell it for a profit so they can continue fighting in their civil war and, you know, destroying Israel and all these other things that they want to do. The problem is they didn't have the capacity or capability to take the oil off. So it ended up just sitting there. So this vessel has been, this FSO Safer, this monstrous oil vessel, which, by the way, holds four times the amount of oil that the Exxon Valdez vessel held, which, you know, that spill was an environmental disaster for all of us to remember through in history. Well, this would have been four times greater if this ship would have cracked, believe it or not. But anyways, they couldn't get it out of there. This ship is just sitting there with all this oil on there, and then it started to rust. It started to break down, and the UN said this thing could potentially just crack and leave all this oil to be spread throughout the Red Sea. It would be an environmental disaster. Eventually, the UN ended up buying this thing and seizing it and now pumping the oil off of it. This is just last year in 2023. And now they're in a process of breaking the ship down and getting it out of the water. But that could have been an absolutely devastating issue, not just an annoyance. More recently, the Houthis attacked the Rubmayar, a Belize-flagged and UK-owned cargo ship, with a ballistic missile. This happened just last month, about 30 days ago so this would be in February. Off the coast of Yemen, it was eventually evacuated, but the ship sunk. And now on that ship was 41,000 tons of fertilizer, which would end up being, again, another potential economic or ecological disaster, rather, for the western coast of Yemen. Right? There is a vibrant fishing industry there. Some of the world's largest coral reefs are right off the Yemen coast. And desalinization plants supply millions and millions of people with drinking water from this area that would be affected by this if this fertilizer were to find its way into the water. What makes it even worse is that there are unique swirling waters within the Red Sea area, which would just end up causing, it wouldn't just sit there. It would end up pushing this fertilizer further and further away. It would be a unique scenario, again, causing so many issues for so many people. You might ask why the Houthis spend so much time focusing on shipping. Well, I mean, it's simply because of where they're located, right there in the southwest portion of the peninsula. They can control the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which is the southern entrance into the Red Sea, vital waterway that connects all the way to the north end of the Red Sea, obviously through the Suez Canal. And any disruptance there could cause billions and billions and billions of dollars of damage. The Suez Canal alone usually gets between 50 and 60 vessels per day. 19,000 per year is the estimate, and has 30, which is 30% of the global container traffic, believe it or not. 10% of the global seaborne oil flows through this region. Okay, so this Bab el-Mandeb Strait, this southern entrance right off the tip of Yemen, is a huge, huge concern for all those ships and a huge concern from the international community. And so if you're the Houthis and you want to have an effect on your greater mission, which is either affecting Israel, affecting Saudi Arabia, upsetting the United States, how about going after a bunch of shipping containers that flow right through your Gulf of Aden, right through that little Bab el-Mandeb Strait, and end up upsetting the entirety of the international community? Makes sense. Oh, and to add a little flair to the mix, they also seized the ship in 2023 that's owned in part by an Israeli businessman and seized the thing completely and turned it into a tourist attraction on which they're now holding weddings. Listen to this.
We are here to visit the galaxy which was captured by our naval forces. We are only targeting Israeli ships or those cooperating with Israel.
Since the 19th of November, Yemen's Houthi forces have launched a series of attacks on commercial and military ships on a critical maritime waterway in the Red Sea. It's disrupted global trade on a route connecting Europe to Asia through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. Ibrahim says a military combat helicopter is perhaps an easier mode of transport to the seized ship, which is partly owned by an Israeli billionaire businessman's company. Registered in the Isle of Man, the Polish-made Bahamian-flagged carrier was chartered by a Japanese shipping company when it was intercepted en route from Turkey to India. On board, the ship's 25 crew members, who are safe in an undisclosed location, we're told, are replaced by hundreds of Yemeni visitors.
Traditional dancing and drumming aboard the galaxy leader. That man in the middle, this is his wedding, he's the groom. There may be a crisis on the Red Sea, but aboard the ship, the spirit right now is very festive.
So the next question is, what do we do? What is it that the United States and its allies can do to try and mitigate this threat? You know, one, to stop the humanitarian crisis that exists down in Yemen now, and then to stop the attacks on international shipping and shooting at our allies in Saudi Arabia. That's a tough question. The first challenge is that while they are supported by Iran, they are given weapons and money, they aren't fully controlled by Iran. They are a proxy, much like Hezbollah, much like Hamas in Gaza, much like the Shia militia groups in Iraq. They have their own reasons for existence. It's just that Iran uses these entities, uses these groups to further their goals throughout the region. Sometimes they can control them, sometimes they can't. And we've talked about this in an earlier episode, but intel hasn't come out that stated Iran gave the go-ahead for the October 7th attacks in Israel. They may not have. Hamas could have done it completely on their own. And when I say they're on their own, I mean in directly as it affected October 7th. Now, they've clearly been trained and supported by Iran operationally, strategically, but tactically, they may have had nothing to do with what happened that day. So we can't just tell Iran or influence Iran completely to make the Houthis stop doing what they're doing. That's a challenge. The other challenge is, and we go back into history to get some to get some examples here is one thing that has worked in the past isn't something that we're interested in doing today. For hundreds of years, again, for a historical example, for hundreds of years, the Barbary pirates, or who were called the Turkish corsairs, they were wreaking havoc outside of Tunis, Algiers, and Tripoli, attacking ships left and right, particularly to steal slaves. That's what they were looking to do. They were either stealing individuals to sell into slavery, or were taking slaves already and then just reselling them. They had like a fleet of 60 ships. They were attacking people, attacking ships all the way north into England, down across the west coast of Africa, basically conducting like raids on land and on sea. At one point, it was so bad that England gathered a committee to negotiate swaps for some of these individuals, some of these people that were stolen, for money. 3,000 to 5,000 English were held in Algiers at one point. Oliver Cromwell, just as an anecdote, was so mad at what was happening and his inability to do anything about it that he ordered the slow drowning of captured pirates, which didn't end up stopping anybody. Eventually, they did have a heavy-handed approach in which the U.S. participated, the Netherlands, Spain, France, Britain as well, which ended up causing the release of many people who were hostage. The U.S. ended up fighting two named wars, in particular against the pirates, both in the early 1800s. And interestingly, the Marine Corps hymn from the shores of Tripoli references this particular time under then-President Jefferson. And so Jefferson attempted to hold negotiations with the Barbary pirates because they were affecting American shipping as well. That didn't work. So he ended up having two wars and went in after these individuals along with the Allies, went after the pirates forcefully and held two wars. That's something we can't do in Yemen. We're not that we can't, but won't. You know, the United States and NATO, whatever group of countries you come up with, are not in a position right now. They have not an interest to go into Yemen and try to eradicate an insurgent group that happens to be attacking international shipping. So the United States and others, they fire back, they shoot cruise missiles, they attempt to harass and intimidate and try and suppress some of the activity of the Houthis. Obviously, we'll take back ships in any way we can with the Navy if they go ahead and seize our shipping, but we're not going to go in and actually eradicate them. And it sounds as if that's, if you look, again, looking into history, is probably one of the real ways that we can make any effect here, and it's just not going to happen. The other issue is, and the reason that it's such a big deal today, is, and the Houthis have made this pretty clear, and you can hear in one of the Houthi spokesmen here, is the Houthis are upset at the current operations that the IDF are conducting in Gaza.
This morning in Eilat, in the southern sector, IDF forces identified an aerial target that was approaching Israeli territory. Alert was sounded, there is no threat, and there is no danger.
Yemen's Houthi rebels confirmed they were behind the drone attack.
Our armed forces have launched a large barrage of ballistic and guided missiles, as well as a significant number of drones at various targets of the Israeli enemy within the occupied territories.
Now, clearly, we don't want to bow down to that rhetoric if you're a supporter of operations in Gaza. We don't want to bow to that rhetoric and say, well, the Houthis are mad, so I guess we'll stop, or I guess Israel's going to stop. That's not going to happen. So it looks like, you know, we may be dealing with some of these one-off attacks and issues with seizing vessels here and there until the operations in Gaza cease, whenever Prime Minister Netanyahu decides that's going to happen. Hopefully, fingers crossed, the activity against international shipping will reduce at that point. But that doesn't mean that the civil war is going to end, and they're certainly going to continue to attack Saudi Arabia and potentially even Israel going forward, just as a reprisal for whatever they had done in Gaza. So it looks as if there isn't much that we're going to be able to do, because the options on the table to actually have an effect are really not going to be one that we choose. So it looks as if the Houthis are going to continue menacing the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. So those are the Houthis, focused on a civil war against the, quote, official government in Yemen, just another entity, another proxy of Iran who does not like Israel, believes they should not exist, right? Just read the flag. And is going to continue fighting against what they believe is Saudi influence. And as long as the Saudis remain a partner and an ally of the United States, which I don't foresee changing, then, you know, we're going to have a thorn in our side when it comes to the Houthis. And unfortunately, the civilians within Yemen are going to continue to feel the negative effects as well. So we'll continue to watch and we'll monitor and we'll see. But we'll see if we can get any positive change out of the Houthis operations in Yemen. But it doesn't look like it's going to be doesn't look like we're going to see any big changes anytime soon. So don't forget, if you want to get in contact, send any questions, suggestions, complaints, anything that you may have, feel free. Send me an email, johnmollick@headlinesinhistory.com. You could find me on social. You can find me on YouTube, Instagram. Shoot me a comment. Whatever it is, show suggestions. If you have questions about anything I talked about today, I'm always ready and willing to respond. Thanks for taking the time here today to listen about our Iranian proxy in Yemen, and we will definitely see you next episode.